Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mealer here. On this edition, we'll talk a little bit about the role that horticulture and agriculture agents play at the UW Extension. We'll talk about the Harmony Arboretum near Marinette. And of course, we will take all of your gardening questions. So I hope you join in. Scott Royce, our guest today from our Green Bay studios. He is the UW Extension Crops, Soils, and Horticulture Agent for Marinette, Oconto, and Florence counties. So you may have some questions for Scott. I hope you'll join in the conversation. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Scott Royce, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Really great to have you with us. You know, there's been a lot in the news the last few days about some sort of mergers and so forth going on within the UW system and co-op extension. I thought it was a good time maybe to spend a minute or two talking about what a UW extension horticulture agent does, aside from once in a while appearing on this show.
Well, I'm a true generalist, at least on the plant side of life, and I've been in my role for 20-plus years now, so I've done a little bit of everything when it comes to that, because in reality, the number one job of being an educator in a county office, which is, you know, there is an extension office in every county in the state of Wisconsin, and the primary job is meeting the needs of our primary constituents, which are the county residents there. And, you know, as you mentioned, I have a little bit more specific role in that I'm the plant side of programming life in three counties, but I'm primarily housed in Marinette County. So I meet all of those needs first and foremost, and that varies a lot from year to year. You know, this year when we have a 1 in 400 year as far as Marinette County went for moisture, you know, I'm dealing with a lot more issues regarding planting delays and, you know, soil saturation issues and, you know, soil compaction and things like that in the farm field. And with the economic situation in agriculture as it is right now, dealing with farms who are trying to figure out, okay, how do I stay in business, much less how do I make any money at all? So, you know, it's a very wide billboard of activities when you try putting them down on paper.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. It's one of the reasons that Jill and I really enjoy having co-op extension Horton Ag agents on the show, because you folks know a lot about a lot of different topics when it comes to plants.
Yeah, we tend to characterize ourselves as a jacks of all trades and masters of none when it comes to those of us in the counties. You know, when people are calling in, they can probably get an idea of that, because I can cover general topics across everything, all the way from wildlife damage to, you know, weed ID, and which weed ID over the phone is always fun. You know, that any of that kind of stuff is always kind of enjoyable trying to do that. But, you know, I do a little bit of everything. But I don't necessarily work with the same thing every week like our specialists get to. So I don't know the exceptional details of some of the things that people may call in about. You know, like I'm not going to be able to answer, well, what cultivar of marigold should I plant in a particular, you know, that kind of stuff I don't know. But
well, you get, as I would bet you get a broad range of questions every week.
Yeah, most weeks, you know, at this time of the year, it's usually fruit-related pest management questions, you know, because people are still, you know, they're looking at their fruit that's in storage, or they're harvesting the last of stuff, and doing things like that, maybe getting ready for next year as far as, okay, what are some things I should be doing yet this fall to get ready for next year? That's the kind of stuff we're usually dealing with when we get into November.
Well, we already have several callers online. By the way, if you'd like to join in, I think there's one open line left at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org, or go ahead and post a photo and or question on our Facebook page. Love to have you join in today on the program. And you know what? Let's just take a phone call. Lee in Williams Bay, it is your turn. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I have a trumpeter vine that's kind of growing through a tree on my property, and the hummingbirds love the trumpeter flowers. And I'd like to trim the tree back a little bit, but I wanted to ask your person that's on, when do the trumpeter vines set their buds or flowers? Is it safe to trim that tree back now, or when is the best time, please? And thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
I'm going off of memory on that one because that's not a species I have a lot of experience with because we're kind of marginal on hardiness for most of the trumpet vines up in my neck of the woods. My memory is that they form their flower buds on new growth, so you should be able to prune them back as pertinent. Basically whenever you get to it, I'm always a fan of later season, later dormant season, I need to say that correctly, pruning rather than early season because if we get some extreme temperatures and we see any dieback, you might be cutting off the stuff that would have otherwise survived and you left the stuff that's going to die. So I tend to prefer waiting until we get into March and early April to do pruning along those lines just to ensure the fact that you're doing the right thing for the plant. But that said, if now is the only time you can get to it, then you got to do it and just kind of take your best guess on what's the healthiest and most energetic tissue and leave that for next year's growth.
There you go. Thanks so much for that call. Shirley in Marengo, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We have a Honeycrisp apple tree that's about 3 years old now, and the main leader broke in the last snowstorm that we had. We had that wet, heavy snow that dropped about 5 inches. So it has two other branches a little lower than the main leader. We're wondering if that tree might be salvageable.
I would definitely say it is. The trick, of course, is going to be that it's going to want to develop a new leader. I'm envisioning a young apple tree in my mind when I'm answering your question. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. But usually younger trees, it's better to have an accident like that happen early rather than later just because of the simple fact that the younger trees are better able to recover from it because they've got plenty of growth potential left in them. They're still at their stages of life when they're going to be able to put on a good amount of growth every year. So what you may need to help the tree do in the future is essentially help it select the stronger, better of those upper branches to be the new leader, up to the point of actually pruning back the secondary one that you maybe don't want to be the leader so that there is a distinct height difference.
Sure.
There's a concept essentially called apical dominance, where the uppermost and outermost buds on a branch produce hormones that inhibit the growth of the rest of the tree. And in younger trees, we want that. We actually want an autocrat when we're dealing with trees. We don't want a diplomacy when it comes to trees because that leads to death by committee. And you want to have a strong bud in place that's producing those hormones, that's keeping the rest of the tree in check, because then the energy of the tree is going to good, strong growth that is going to set the tree up well for the future.
There we go.
That sounds good. Now, the break is kind of sharp. Would we want to just leave it like that, or would we want to, make a cut in it and kind of smooth it out, or just leave it the way it broke?
It's always a good idea to go ahead and take either a pruner's or a good pruning saw and just smooth that cut off, because then you have less surface area for insect and disease issues to occur.
Okay. Now,
the advantage you have is that it occurred during essentially the early part of the dormant season now, so you don't have as much issues. But if you see something like that happen during the growing season when we have moisture and we have higher temperatures, that's where it's actually even more important to do that, to get those wind breakage or storm damage points and smooth them off so that the bark can try to start reforming over there and you get a little bit better wound tissue formation and less opportunity for diseases and insects to get into that wounded area.
Okay, well, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Bonnie in Germantown, it's your turn. Hi, Bonnie.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love your gardening show.
Thank you.
I have a two-part question about my garden. I already cleaned out the residual tomato plants and squash, and I had my garden soil tested 2 years ago. It said that I was low on potassium. It said I need a pound per 100 square feet, but I don't know how to put that in there, and wondering if pine needles are a good mulch, because I want to keep my garden organic.
Okay. I program in areas that are dominated by sandy soils, so I'm used to this kind of question because it's one of the most common ones I get when it comes to soil management, because our soils don't hold potassium very well. So certainly getting potassium into a managed plant area is one of the things we need to think about when we're growing managed plants in a sandier soil or a depleted soil. It could be a better soil too, it just been depleted. And the nice thing about potassium is that we have more time flexibility than when we're dealing with a nutrient like nitrogen, which we can lose over the course of time pretty easily, especially in a wet year like we had last year. So with potassium, as long as you can work the soil, you can put in a potassium base. You know, it can be whether it's an organic source or a synthetic source like Myriad of Potash, and get that worked in a little bit. And basically the potassium stays in general where you put it. Now, if we get a really wet year on sandy soils, it will leach out to some extent, but it doesn't move quickly like nitrogen will do. One of the better ways to get potassium and all of the rest of the 17 nutrients that our plants need in to get that into the soil is to use an organic matter amendment. And whether you want to use something like a mature compost or in the fall or very early spring, you're putting in something that still needs to break down, like leaves, pine needles, as you mentioned, or other things. Whatever you can get that's cheap or free, those are the best ones as far as I'm concerned. I'm not a huge fan of going out and spending money on things that we can probably find in our own landscape or next door or something. Just try to watch out for certain types of diseases, especially this year. But that's where bringing in something like pine needles and working them in, or composting them first and then working them in, is a pretty good idea in a landscape or garden situation, because there aren't any diseases or insects that are going to transfer from those conifers to our other managed plants. So I'm certainly fine with that. The one thing you'll notice with conifer needles, if you just work them in or use them as a mulch, they are a little bit slower decaying because of the waxes that are on the outside layer, that cuticle layer of those needles. So they are a little bit slower to decay, which is a good thing when using them as a mulch. A little bit frustrating sometimes if you're trying to use them as an organic matter amendment.
Okay, so I could probably throw those on the garden surface now, and that would be a good mulch, and work it in spring maybe?
It can serve essentially as a wind erosion control and to keep that soil in place a little bit better. And it can also, if you're working with any tender perennials now, you know, now that we've got frozen soil or at least crunchy soil in most parts of the state, now is the time to mulch around any perennials that you're a little bit concerned about, you know, that they're a little bit marginally hardy. And certainly conifer needles or other coarse mulches like straw, hay, things like that are a better way to mulch around them rather than something flat that can compact down like maple leaves. So mm-hmm. Certainly the conifer needles play a pretty good role in our gardens in those senses.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's very good to know. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Bonnie, for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Scott Royce, UW Extension Crops Soils Horticulture Agent for Marinette, Oconto, and Florence counties. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network for Garden Talk. Scott Royce from UW Extension, where he is a crop, soils, and horticulture agent for Marinette, Oconto, and Florence counties. Great to have him along. Thank you for joining in. Call in 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Sue and Mequon, you're up. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for your show. I love your UW experts.
Thank you.
I'd like to
clean out my garden beds in the fall, and I've done that. We've been advised, though, not to put down amendments. Like, I want to put some chopped leaves around my perennials and whatever until we get a certain amount of cold weather, so we're not providing a nice home for our mice and voles. Have we had enough cold weather? I know we're a lot not as cold as you've been up there, but when can I do that? I live in southeast Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. The general recommendation is to wait until the soil is crunchy. Yes, that's a technical term, crunchy versus frozen solid. So essentially, you know, and as you mentioned, you know, we've had a few days of significantly cooler weather up this direction. So, and normally I say in northern Wisconsin, somewhere between Halloween and Thanksgiving is usually the right time. As we go further south in the state, it probably gets closer more to that Thanksgiving, early December time frame. So it's kind of up to you, especially I don't worry as much about rodents in most situations just because they don't have as much habitat in a, you know, depending on your exact area. Now, if you live in an area where you've got a lot of wooded area fairly close, then yes, there's some definite credence to waiting a little bit longer, because those meadow voles, which are the most damaging ones, can come in and cause some problems for your woody perennials. Now, if you're mulching around just herbaceous perennials where you don't need to worry about mammal damage above ground, then it really doesn't matter. And then, as long as you've got soil that is cooled down to essentially the freezing point, you could probably go ahead and do it right away. We're going to get a little bit warmer weather the way it looks next week again, so I wouldn't be afraid to wait a couple more weeks either. But if now is when you have the time and ability to get out there and do it, you shouldn't be hurting anything by doing it now.
There you go.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Sue. Appreciate it. Francesco in Sister Bay, your turn now. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a spread of land, numerous acres in Kewaunee County. And I'm very sad by the fact that most county departments treat the milkweed as a noxious weed. And I would like to see if you could help me find seed to put my acreage to as a refuge for an feeding station for the monarch butterfly.
All right.
There's certainly commercial sources of milkweed seed out there, both the common milkweed as well as some of our other native milkweeds like whorled and swamp milkweed, which are even better for pollinators than the standard common milkweed. On public land in the state of Wisconsin, you do have the right to collect seed from plants as well. So if you have a stand on public land that is fairly close to you, that's legal to do. You can't dig the plants up and transplant them, but you can collect seed and then put that seed in. But certainly places like Prairie Nursery and any of the other nurseries, I tend to lean toward ones that are native to Wisconsin or at least the upper Midwest to get native plants from, because they're better adapted to our environment. So you may even be able to go through like your local land and water conservation departments. They may have sources of seed where they'll do bulk orders with you. I'm not certain about Door and Kewaunee County if they do that or not, but it would be an option to look into at least.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Richard in Madison, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Richard.
Hi. This is a comment, not a question. I'm not a gardener, really. And I had to take over the garden after my wife passed away. And I didn't know what to do. I called up the UW Extension Horticulture, or I emailed Doug Soldat,
yep,
the turf guy.
Yep.
He said, that's not really my area. Better that I refer you. I will email or send your email to Lisa Johnson or someone like that.
Yeah, Lisa Johnson, no doubt.
A ton of information on cover crops. So I planted buckwheat. I planted perennial rye. I did it because of UW Extension people.
Oh. Well, that's a nice that's a nice story. Richard, thank you so much for calling. And Scott, I hope you hear that once in a while.
Yeah, we usually get the good comments back, you know, because I do a lot of stuff with fruit trees and such. Well, the fun ones for me are when people come to one of my fruit tree pruning workshops and then see me a year and a half, 2 years later and say, you know, my tree actually came around now and it's starting to do what I wanted it to because I'm starting to understand how to manage it.
That's great. Richard, again, thank you so much for those comments. I really appreciate it. Paul in Cross Plains has something for us. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live on a hill in Cross Plains. Just as soon as the glacier stopped, our property began, and we live out on the brink of this hill, and the hill had been pastured, actually over-pastured by the previous owner. So we built our house right close to the edge, and now the hill is overgrown with buckthorn because it was so overpastured. And I've gone off with a chainsaw, and I would clear out a half an acre at a time and stack up the buckthorn thinking I was going to get it under control. And the next spring I would have a carpet of buckthorn because the seed bed was just so intense underneath these trees. So I've decided what I need to do is to graze the hill back with something that will eat buckthorn. What is that?
I think goats will do it, won't they?
Yeah, goats are pretty good browsers. In younger phases of growth, beef animals will usually do pretty well on stuff like that, too. Although I'm trying to remember, I don't think buckthorn has any toxicity issues with it at all. Pretty sure it doesn't. So there'd be a few options there. This is one of those classic cases where the weeds, in this case buckthorn, they're the symptom of the problem more than they're the problem themselves, although because they're getting started, now they're becoming the problem too. So it's a multi-step situation probably, where certainly if you want, you know, grazing is an option to consider. You're going to have that seed bed, and as you found out, you know, when you cut trees down along the biological lines of buckthorn and a bunch of other trees, they resprout both from root buds as well as allowing seedlings space to get started. So you can end up with a pretty thick carpet, certainly. Tillage, grazing, tillage in the situation you mentioned, probably not a great option either since you're on top of a hill in a glacial till area, or the edge of glacial till. But there would be herbicidal options to consider as well, depending on your philosophical approach to it and how serious and how fast you want to get rid of the stuff. But certainly grazing animals are an opportunity. Just make sure that the perimeter fence is secure, because that's one aspect of Wisconsin fence laws. You have to have a perimeter fence. But then with buckthorn control, you're going to probably want to do some type of a rotational grazing situation to essentially force those animals to feed on that brush, because if it isn't a preferred forage, they're going to eat everything else first, and then they'll eat the buckthorn. But that may not fit into your management needs. So do a few extra pieces of work like that, and it can actually probably work for you then.
Well, I've read articles and heard, I think on this show, discussions of using Scottish longhorn cattle or the...
Yeah, the Scottish Highlanders,
Highlanders, yeah. And I've seen pictures where they actually seem to prefer the buckthorn over grass. One
that
will
be
tipping the buckthorn over while the other chews on it.
Yeah, and they are a great breed because they're very durable, very hardy, smaller stature and smaller size, so fencing doesn't need to be quite as sound and secure either. So certainly there, the downside is because they're a specialty breed, they're a little bit pricier than a lot of the other breeds of cattle that you could get started with, but certainly a really good option. And I don't know enough in their foraging needs to know for sure that the buckthorn is a preferred species, but with their background, I would certainly believe it.
Do you have any recommendations on people that do fencing for that sort of thing?
Yeah, that would be, you know, there's usually regional companies that do that. And if it was pastured in the past, there's probably some level of perimeter fence still there. You can do it on your own, too. It's just a matter of spending the time and money to do it. But certainly there are a number of good fencing companies in the area. Your local extension office may have a listing of stuff like that available, or your local NRCS office, because NRCS actually has cost share monies available for setting up rotational grazing systems. At least most offices do, so they would probably have that that type of resource on hand too.
The NRCS?
NRCS, Natural Resource Conservation Service, and they're usually housed along with the other USDA side of life, which is the Farm Service Agency.
So I would contact them in Dane County for information about
this. Or the Dane County Extension Office. Either one would probably have some opportunities for you for farm-based fencing.
Super. Thank you very much. It's quite helpful.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Appreciate the call. And let's go to Dave in Campbellsport next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, guys. I grew some strawberries in, aluminum rain gutters this summer. I've got them sitting on my deck on top of sawhorses. I was thinking about digging a trench in my garden and setting the gutters in there and then covering them with straw for the winter. But then I thought, well, the top 5 inches of the garden are going to probably freeze solid. So my question is it worth the effort to go through that, or should I just leave them on the sawhorses to overwinter? Will they survive?
I'll start with the last question and then go backwards from there. The last question, the answer is a definite no. They wouldn't. There's no prayer of them surviving if you leave them on the sawhorses. Strawberries are by far our least hardy of all of our fruit crops, and it's because their crown is right at the surface of the soil, and they will start having dieback when their temperature hits 15 degrees. So when they're in the soil, it takes a fair amount of cold to get down to 15 degrees, even in that right at the soil surface. But you put them on a sawhorse like that, they may be pushing close. And put it this way, if they were at my place, last night they would have gotten down to 15 degrees because we had single digits.
Oh, boy.
Okay. So, yes, you definitely will want to trench them in. It's not a bad idea. And let me say that, although I worry a little bit about root rots in a situation like that with strawberries. But go ahead, trench them in and mulch them fairly heavily. That, what we just talked about, is the reason that strawberries are the one fruit crop that we need to mulch for overwinter protection. Some grape cultivars as well, but strawberries are the poster child for not being quite hardy enough in our environment, even though technically they're hardy. It's just their biology is quite a bit different than any of our other fruit crops.
Okay, well, hopefully I'll have to go outside and check, see if any of them are still alive.
Well, odds are, if you're in Campbellsport, if I heard that correctly, you should be fine yet. But up in Wausaukee last night, we were cold.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Oh, man. Thanks, Dave. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Steve on Facebook says he runs his mulch mower over the yard a few times to take care of the leaves in his yard. He'd like to know if he can mow until there's snow on the ground, and will a large amount of mulch leaves affect grass growth?
It will affect it, and usually it will affect it positively. You have to be a little bit cautious on that. If you have a really heavy leaf load, you can maybe overdo it and end up with getting essentially a coverage layer where you're actually inhibiting light penetration. Now, at this time of the year, that shouldn't be a problem either, but in early spring, you don't want to have too heavy of a mulch layer because it could actually inhibit that new growth. But in general, with good mulching mowers, they cut them up fine enough that they start breaking down over winter pretty well, and we get pretty good nutrient and organic matter availability into the soil over the long term from that. So that is a very good practice in most situations.
And I can tell you that tomorrow morning at along about 9:30 or 10 maybe, I'll have the mulch mower out on my lawn. I do it every year, and it seems to work great for the leaves. Paula in Racine, it's your turn. Hi, Paula.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A couple of calls ago, you were talking about milkweed plants, and There's a wild stand on my family's farm up in Florence County, but I live in Racine. Can I transplant those plants, and when's the best time to do that?
Well, this is one of those situations where theory and reality might not be the same thing. Certainly from the, you know, you would have the ability to transplant them. The trick with milkweed is that the crown system of milkweed is usually between 18 and 24 inches deep in the soil.
Okay.
So unless you have a backhoe, it's kind of tough to transplant them sometimes. Now, you can certainly try it, and if you can find smaller plants and get down deep enough in the, I would do that in the spring, and you might be able to do it. But you probably, quite honestly, would be just as well off to collect seed, start them off as seedlings, and go that direction, because that's the reason that milkweed is so hard to control if you're trying to control it where you, in a spot where you really don't want it, is because that crown and most of the root system is so deep in the soil.
Okay, so if I do the seeds then, like, start them in the house and in like a little seed starters, or can I just put them in like a prairie area?
You could do it either way. You know, if you want a little bit more predictability to where they're going to be and their success rate, then you would want to start them indoors. And they usually do start fairly easily. But if you can collect enough seed and just scatter it, they'll probably get going on their own too.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. Love your show.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Dick in Brookfield, it is your turn. Hi, Dick. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a different patches of lighter green grass in my yard. When you walk on it, it feels like you're kind of on a carpet, like it's not even attached to the soil almost. But I don't know what it is. Matter of fact, I always went out and pulled some out when I was waiting. It's really very thin pieces of grass, and underneath the bottom part's all brown. So if I lift it up, I can see like brown roots underneath it. I don't know what that is or how to get rid of it.
Okay. Under the assumption that you've been, have you been dealing with that for a while and it's definitely overwintering?
No, I think in the summertime too. It just kind of appears during the summer it appears. It's not. I went online. I couldn't find anything that could be, this. So.
One of the better ways to deal with something like this is if you don't know for sure what you're dealing with, try to get it identified. You know, take a sample into your county extension office or somebody else that you trust. You know, there are some very good people at lawn and garden centers and such too. So but get it positively identified at minimum to whether it's a perennial or an annual grass that you're dealing with, because your description, I can picture a couple of both types that it could potentially be. So
it's perennial. It's perennial. It's every year it's there. It just gets a little bit bigger sometimes.
And, okay. Well, then, if it's one of the perennial turf grass type species that just doesn't match the rest of your turf grasses, realistically, about the only thing you can do if you want to get rid of it is to either dig that area up, spray it, or cover it with plastic and let the plastic sit there for a month or two, and then reseed, you know, till that area and reseed with a preferred mix of turf grasses. Now, if Doug were on or one of the other turf type specialists, they might have a few other ideas for you. But that, from my standpoint, that's about the only options you probably have.
I was kind of thinking that was the option. I wanted to make sure that, but it's your opinion, but now that's probably what I'd have to do.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can get another opinion. Like you said, that's very nice that you're the county extension, I think, is the way to go.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Joan in Madison. Your turn. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. I love your show.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm wondering if we even have to rake our leaves. I remember one year I have two big maple trees in my backyard, and I didn't do it. I didn't rake the leaves that year. For some reason, I just didn't want to do it. So when I'd walk out in the backyard, when it started to get warm, I had greenish brown footprints in the snow, and I thought, oh, my God, I've killed every blade of grass there is in my yard. But come spring, everything came up beautifully. So I'm beginning to wonder, why rake at all if it's, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is this because society wants us to do it, or is this nature, it takes care of itself?
I would say that it's a little bit of both, probably. I mean, your neighbors would probably appreciate it if you rake, because then they don't have to re-rake. You know, there's that issue of it. But from the plant biology side of life, there are certainly a couple of valid reasons to consider raking. But it's really more about your desires and needs, and then also how good you want your lawn to look underneath those leaves. If the leaves are dry, if you have a species of deciduous tree that's dropping its leaves earlier in the fall, and we still have a lot of growing season left, especially a year like this where a lot of areas of the state didn't get killing frosts until just not all that long ago. There, if you get a layer of leaves on and they're stopping light penetration to the turf grasses, that's going to cause some issues for your turf grass. Now, it may not kill it. I'm not saying that, but it's going to be an extra source of stress. And that's, you know, that can be a problem. And the same thing would occur in the spring, that it's going to slow that grass growth down in the spring if you still have a layer of leaves. Now, if it's a type of leaf that breaks down fairly quickly, it doesn't form a mat, it doesn't make a full covering, you know, a full blanket of leaves, then, yeah, you have a lot more flexibility. You can either just leave them or mow over them with even a normal mower, and you're going to probably take care of them perfectly fine. You know, for myself as a gardener and a wife who is seriously into perennial flowers, we use every leaf we can find, and because we're mulching and we're doing other stuff and getting those leaves onto the areas where we need them for organic matter and for nutrients. So it is more of a personal choice than anything else, but you have to balance that with what you really want your lawn to look like, both yet this fall and then next year.
I've never had any problem with a lawn. But what about our woodlands, all the leaves that fall in our woodlands in areas where you can't rake? What's the effect of that? I'm sure it decomposes and gives nutrients and stuff like that.
Yep, yeah, that layer of natural mulch that we have in our forested areas is what makes that ecosystem thrive. And that's why some of the invasive worm species are so bad for forests, you know, including night crawlers, jumping worms, which have been a source of discussion on this show relatively recently. Mm-hmm. You know, those things are bad because they recycle those leaves so much faster than the fungi and bacteria that normally do the decomposition in a forested situation. Because that natural layer of mulch is the perfect layer of insulation, and it's the perfect layer of growth for next year's roots and the fungi that form positive symbiotic relationships with those roots. So without that natural layer of mulch, our woodlands become very stressed.
Yeah.
So it's the way to leave it. It's necessary to leave it in a natural situation. In a managed plant situation, it's obviously a great way to do it, but it has to fit in with your management desires.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Royce, our guest today, UW Extension Crop Soils Horticulture Agent for Marinette, Oconto, and Florence Counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Scott Royce, horticulture agent for Marinette, Oconto, and Florence Counties. Great to have him along. And join in. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Alan in La Crosse next. Alan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is we recently bought a house that has several apple trees on it, about five apple trees, Honeycrisp and Red Delicious. And I was wondering what I need to be doing this year to make sure that they have a healthy winter, and then what are some things I need to do in the spring. They did have some apple scab on them this year, and I understand there are some products that you can use. It's about timing when you apply it. And then also another question I have is I have some ramp seeds, and I'm not sure if you know much about ramps, and if you do, is it too late this year to get those in the ground? And I'll take your comments off the air.
All right, thanks. Are these young trees, by the way, or are they older established trees?
They're older established trees.
Okay. All right. Scott, what do you think?
On the ramp seed side of things, so ramp or wild leek, you may still be able to get them established. It's definitely late. They prefer to be sown earlier in the season. You know, naturally, their seeds are going to be falling in basically midsummer. So it's possible to still sow them and have some success, but you might be better served just storing the seed properly and then putting them in the ground next year. On the fruit tree management side of life, you mentioned scab, which is our most common fungal disease of both apple and pear trees, and certainly with the humidity and moisture that a lot of us experienced this last year, scab was pretty rampant. So it does form an extra decision point for us when we're doing things this fall yet. So if you had, in whether it's fruit trees or herbaceous perennial flowers or vegetable gardens, whatever it is that you're cleaning up, if you had particular foliar or stem type diseases that you were battling this last growing season, now is the time to get that material off of there. Now, you know, we've been talking about leaving leaves in place and doing things like that. And normally, yeah, that's a great thing to do. But if you had a pretty significant disease problem, you actually want to get that material off of those growing areas and either compost them and then use them in a totally separate area, you know, like a totally different type of plant growth area, or just actually get rid of them or put them into a natural woodland area in the neighborhood or whatever makes sense for you. Obviously, you can go to a municipal compost facility, whatever is correct in your area. So that's one thing, is this: if you were dealing with scab, it's a good idea to get rid of that extra leaf material that's around those trees, get them away from there, because that can help try to slow the disease down next year. The next step of scab management is proper pruning. Proper pruning is what I call it steps 1 through 3 of fruit tree pest management. Because if you don't have good light penetration and you don't have good airflow in your fruit trees, you automatically are increasing the disease and insect issues that your trees are going to have to face. So especially on older trees, if you inherited them, as it sounds like it may have been, you're probably going to be needing to do some proper pruning. And go online, get good proper pruning resources. There's YouTube videos. There's all kinds of stuff. There's good sources of information out there. A lot of locales will have pruning workshops in the early spring, late winter that you can attend and get some hands-on help to. But do your pruning, get those areas thinned out, get the weak branches out, you know, the weak growth, the crossing growth, the stuff that's just out in the middle of nowhere that shouldn't be, and try to thin that canopy out a little bit as pertinent, because that will help manage the scab in the future. And then if you had it pretty severely last year, it still may be worth it to do a little bit of a fungicidal management approach to it. Now, there aren't very many organic-type fungicides that work well against scab. There are some that do, but if you're willing to use a synthetic fungicide, the opportune timing is when the leaves are about half size. So they've budded out, the leaves are starting to get growing, but do that first application of something like a chlorothalonil is probably one of the better active ingredients when it comes to scab management. I'm trying to remember. I think mancozeb and madeb are also labeled for it, but chlorothalonil is probably the best active ingredient. And that first application is important because that stops the primary infections from getting going. And then, depending on the year, you may decide to use it again according to label instructions, but you may want to use it again every 10 to 14 days if we have humid, you know, wettish weather. But you can kind of play that by the growing season.
Yeah. And it just our overall management and care of apple trees, for example, the extension has some nice publications that I think are available, Scott?
Yeah, all of our publications are available free on the web. The ones that you're going to be particularly looking for, the numbers and codes, if you're used to using a Google or whatever search engine you use, if you type a capital A and then 1959, that's one of the numbers for, that's the fruit tree pruning publication, and A2179 is the apple pest management publication. Yeah, I might have them mixed around, but I know one of them is the pruning, and I know one of them is the pest management. So,
there we go. John in Janesville has a question for you. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing? Great show.
Thank you.
I heard you talking about milkweed in terms of growing it, but I have a 1 acre prairie planting around my home. It's an established, been for like 22 years now, actually through Prairie Nurseries information and whatnot, but I had milkweed come in, and I was quite thrilled with the whole monarch thing and all that kind of stuff because I did raise them in the past. And but now milkweed is not playing well with my. It's becoming what I would consider almost invasive and spreading all over. So is there any way I can control it? Mm-hmm. Well, any suggestions on controlling it?
Okay.
How big an area did you have?
About a 1 acre around my home.
All right.
1 acre planting.
It's tough because of where that plant stores its energy, because it's so deep in the soil. It takes a little bit of patience and some time. Usually there aren't too many silver bullets when it comes to monarch management. Yeah, to milkweed management. So certainly if you keep the young plants cut down, eventually they're going to lose their energy, and that portion of the stand is going to die back. So if you have a particular area where you're just sick of dealing with the milkweed, you keep them cut down for the course of one growing season, and you should be able to eradicate them in that small area. There are some herbicides that will do reasonably well against milkweed management or against milkweed, and you're just going to need to find ones that you're comfortable using if you want to go that direction. And again, you may need to be a little bit consistent with application. There aren't too many things that are going to take milkweed out in one application. Now, glyphosate-containing products at the right stage of growth will do reasonably well against them. But you have to be very careful, obviously, when you're using any kind of herbicide in an area like that, because it's going to damage other plants if you get that product onto your preferred plants. So have to be pretty good with your directional treatments or do some type of alternative application techniques. But there are some valid options out there.
Yeah, for sure.
Great. All right, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. I had a few milkweed plants that were in an area I didn't want them, and I simply pulled them.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I had pretty good success with that.
Yeah, it partially goes to timing. If you let them get up a ways where they've expended their energy and then pull them or cut them down, then you're still going to probably have to do it a couple of times.
Yep.
But
yep, there you go. Kathleen and Marshall, thanks for calling.
Hi, I have a question about storing or preparing for storage and actually storing cannas, dahlias, and elephant ears. I have them all dug out of the ground, and I'm keeping them from being frozen outside. But how can I prepare them for storage, and how can they be stored? We don't have the old-fashioned basement, you know, where you can just put your stuff down there and it stays forever. So what do you suggest?
Well, as far as getting them ready for storage, you know, as you mentioned, you know, getting them dug out, now that the material has died, you know, the green material has died back, and just cut all that, the stem material off, you know, you don't need to wash them per se to get them ready for storage. You know, some people will. You know, where they actually wash them and then let them dry off well, that's fine, but you don't need to go that route. But at least get most of the excess soil off as best you can. But you have to be cautious because you don't want to damage those tubers and corms and stuff, depending on which species, going into winter storage. You want to let that stuff stay whole. If you're going to split it before planting. Don't split it now.
No, okay.
And as far as storage conditions, as you kind of mentioned, the perfect opportunity is a root cellar or an old style unheated basement. Those are the perfect storage conditions because you want to store those types of tender materials somewhere in that 40 degree range is kind of optimum. They can handle a little bit warmer as long as it's consistent, you know, 45, maybe up to 50 degrees if you can't get them, but they can't freeze. That's the bad thing. And that's why, like, for myself, I can't store those things because I don't have a place where I can keep them warm enough or cold enough.
Refrigerator?
Refrigerators. It's dicey with refrigerators because they have to be an old style. So, you know, if you're in rural Wisconsin and you have a beer fridge out in the garage, okay, those might work. Just because, because they don't have the automatic defrost units on the freezers. They're what kill plants if you try to store them in fridges. But it'd be a possibility, but... it's probably just a matter of finding the best spot that you have and trying it. And if you have enough material, some of it will probably do all right and others may not. And then you'll maybe be able to adjust what you're trying to keep in upcoming years.
Yeah, makes good sense. Thanks a lot for calling, Kathleen. Scott Royce, our guest today. Scott's a UW Extension Crops, Soils, Horticulture Agent for Marinette, Oconto, and Florence counties, one of the great extension people that does so well on this program. Thanks for listening here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Welcome back to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Scott Royce. He's a UW Extension Crops, Soils, and Horticulture Agent for Marinette, Oconto, and Florence counties. You may have some gardening questions. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And we're going to Hayward next and talk with Scott.
Scott. Hi, Larry and Scott. We're inspired by Larry's limey to purchase a lemon tree. came in the mail this spring, and we planted it in a small container and put it on the deck, and it grew so much by the end of the summer we had to repot it. It's looking real healthy. We brought it into the porch about a month ago and recently brought it inside. I guess what we're wondering is... what do we need to do in terms of nutrients and watering over the winter?
Okay. One of the biggest things you need to think about, too, is humidity. A lot of those types of trees, although citrus are not horrible about it, but a lot of those types of tree houseplants need a little bit higher humidity than a lot of our houses have available to them in winter. So you may potentially need to think about that a little bit and have a smaller space humidifier in a particular area for it. But as far as watering, it's basically about meeting the needs of the plant. And obviously in the winter, they're not going to be photosynthesizing as much. So if anything, people tend to overwater houseplants rather than underwater them, especially in winter. So, but just be consistent. Let the soil get to the point of being, you know, drier. It doesn't need to be bone dry, but drier before you rewater. And then just kind of get in the habit of, you know, because after a few weeks, you should have a little bit of a pretty or a fairly good understanding of how much water it's going through per day or per week, and then have a decent opportunity to just be consistent with it. From a nutrient standpoint, you're probably not going to need to fertilize it much, if at all, over the course of the winter. You may want to use one of the, you know, the water mix bases, whether, you know, whatever brand name you want to use for a liquid nutrient source. But be conservative. You don't want to over fertilize during the winter because they're just not using nearly as many nutrients because they're not putting on much active growth, if at all. And if you overdo it, you can you're not going to cause huge problems. It's not like you're going to kill the plant unless you really radically overdo it, which can happen. If you give it too much nitrogen all at once, you can cause serious problems. But so just be conservative, you know, give them a fairly dilute mix of that solution as one of their waterings, maybe, you know, once a month, once every other month, depending on how big the tree is and how good the soil is that you put it into when you repotted it.
I usually throw a little fishy emulsion material in mm-hmm. with the water when I water, and I usually wind up watering about once a week, but I don't use a lot of water with limey or lime tree.
Yep, yeah, they just, unless you're in a warm, artificially lighted area, they're just not doing that much in winter in our environment.
Yeah, well, I have some grow lights on limey in the winter time too, mm-hmm. when I remember to turn them on in the morning,
yep,
which I forgot this morning. But the south-facing window is really a good opportunity for my tree, yep. Anyway.
Yeah. One thing to remember when you're bringing in plants like that, and obviously it's past that time for most of our stuff, but a lot of people will experience, or their plants will experience leaf drop when you change the environments on them like that. And that is perfectly normal because of the change in growing environment, the change in light conditions. And a lot of our plants, when we bring them in for overwintering purposes, they will drop their leaves and then reform new leaves. And it's pretty normal for most species to do that. Some won't, but a lot of them will.
Limey's holding on to her leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Those are lemony.
Thanks, Rod. Appreciate the call. Joanne in Cambridge says on Facebook that she has several shagbark hickory trees and therefore lots of hickory nuts on the ground. Are these usable for mulch?
To the best of my knowledge, they would be.
You'd see
probably want to run them through a shredder or do something like that because they're not going to hold much air. They're going to be a little bit compact. And certainly, you know, we were talking about attracting rodents before. There's some opportunity to attract rodents there because that's a good food source.
yeah, for sure.
So I don't know that you're going to find them on the recommended lists of mulch materials, but, you know, I could see them working in certain situations.
So Rod in Arlington has a question for you, Scott. Let's go there. Hi, Rod.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
I have a question. My mother-in-law's house, there was a bleeding heart plant, and she's gone to an assisted living facility, and she wants my wife to have the plant, and I've just not made the effort to really check into them. Is now a good time to dig them out for transplant, or better to leave them until the spring, or can they, you know, be stored indoors during the winter months? I don't really know much about them. And how big of an area do I have to dig out for them and how deep?
Okay. The classical extension answer of it depends might apply here a little bit. Now, the reason I say that is because there are quite a few different cultivars and types, and obviously the age of the plant is going to come into play. They are also one that reseed fairly well, so you may be able to find seedlings in that area pretty easily too. So the tricky part of the question is actually the first part of what you said as far as timing. Theoretically, you could still transplant them as long as you have a good mark on the plant, you know, if the material is still there. Because they should be fully dormant now, you could probably still get away with transplanting them, especially if there's a need to do so because of timing issues. You always want to go bigger rather than smaller when you're transplanting in dormant season like this to make sure that you're not hurting the crown system when you dig it out. Now, of course, the problem with that is that you don't want to hurt stuff that's, you know, plants that are neighboring the bleeding heart that you're trying to actually save. I wouldn't recommend trying to use it as a house plant. They do like their dormant period. depending on which one it is, it may work, but I don't have experience with putting them in as a houseplant over winter. So I think you'd be better served to go ahead and try to get transplanted, or just mark it and plan on transplanting it early in the spring next year, which would probably be when most perennial plant people would prefer that you do it, is wait until next spring. But if you need to, you could probably get away with it now that it is fully dormant.
Here we go.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, good enough. Thank you.
Yep, thanks, Rod. And Undine in Marshfield, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I had a comment to make on the person who was talking about growing milkweed so that he had a place for the monarch butterflies. A lot of spread on milkweed is also due to the seed pods ripening and spreading the seeds. So you'd want to cut the seed heads off. And what I've done in the past for other plants that have gotten invasive, say like tall garden phlox that's reseeded, or other plants that just got a little bit too rambunctious in the garden, is I take fresh lawn clippings. They're clean of any herbicide like weed and feed, so I make sure, you know, that's not in the mix. And I take the fresh lawn clippings, the grass, and I pile it about a good 5-6 inches high on the fending areas. And you know what happens when you have a clump of grass left on the lawn after you mow it? It kills the grass back, and it kills it back quite for a long time. You know, it probably takes a good season or so for it to rebound. So you cover your offending invasive plant, you kind of cut it back, heavily mulch with that, about 5-6 inches, let it die down. If you need to treat it again, do the same thing. You're going to fertilize your soil. The earthworms love it. And it's an easy way to kind of get control on some of the more invasive plants.
Huh?
And you're mulching at the same time. So it's a good all-around solution. I used to use lawn clippings quite often to edge my garden beds because I didn't have like brick or a paver edge. And that, you know, I was trying to keep the grass and different things from creeping into the garden beds. And that was very effective. It doesn't look great for a while because it doesn't need to kind of molder down.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it's good. It cuts things back, you know, keeps everything in line. After a while, you can tell it's kind of spent, then you can kind of scrape it, rake it off the area, and put it in your regular compost heap.
Yeah. Well, what do you think, Scott? Sounds like a good plan to me.
It's certainly an option. You know, anything that you do along those lines, any kind of management practice, you just have to be happy with it as you're on your own. You know, because my take on gardening is that it's something that you should enjoy. So if you go out and you don't like the look of something that you're trying to do, well, you're not going to enjoy it, and it's not going to last in the long run then. So not everyone is going to be happy with that type of a method, but from the biological standpoint, it can certainly be an effective way. One of the points she made is something I will emphasize again, though, is make sure you're not using lawn clippings from a lawn that had been treated with, particularly with our broadleaf herbicides, so any of the 2,4-D, dicamba, MCPP type of products, because they will leach out of those lawn clippings and cause pretty significant problems for most of your perennial and annual flowering plants.
Yep.
So do be cautious about that. The only thing I'm going to say from her original comment about taking pods off of monarchs and such like that, she's spot on. It's absolutely one of the best ways there is to prevent extra seedlings from getting started. One of the problems with that, if you're a native insect enthusiast, is those pods are where some insects will actually be overwintering, or not necessarily overwintering, but pupating. But, you know, so nature likes messy things, not perfectly clean, perfectly straight rows, all that kind of stuff. So if you're one of your goals of life of having native prairie plants and such is to increase the native insect populations, we need to do a little less management sometimes and not as much.
We had Barbara send us a note on Facebook. Their big red maple tree has tar spot. Are the leaves okay for mulching?
Okay, this does go back to one of the issues we talked about before. Tar spot, it was everywhere this year. In fact, I did not see a single Norway maple in the counties in which I work that did not have tar spot. That's how bad it was this year. And it also affects some of the other native maples, particularly silver maple, although it's actually two separate fungi. They're both called tar spot. The recommendation is to not use those leaves underneath your susceptible trees. So if you have a Norway maple, which are the red-leaved ones during the growing season, and it had tar spot, the recommendation is to get those leaves out of there and not use them in, you know, around Norway maples again. Is it going to make a gargantuan difference? That's hard to say for sure because we don't know what the weather's going to be like next spring. But the recommendation is to not use those as mulch around a Norway maple again or around the trees, shrubs, whatever it was that you were dealing with that had diseased leaves.
Samantha has a question for us. Samantha, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. My mom lives in a trailer court in Tremplo that has all these pine trees, and nothing will grow under the pine trees or near them, like for flowers. She's not good with indoor plants, but the outdoor plants work best for her to do. You know, what would be the best thing for, like, when spring comes again, for her to be able to plant in her yard?
Are those pines, are the bottom branches cut out so there's a few feet or so?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Fairly common situation. A lot of times when pines are growing in an area, it is indicative that the soil is lower pH. Not guaranteed. You know, pines can grow in a pretty wide range of soil conditions, but it is often that they're sandier, lower pH soils, so that dictates a little bit of what we can try to do under them. It could be a situation where one of the better ways to do things is to actually bury containers and use a compost-based potting soil in those areas and just essentially have containerized plants but bury them so that they look like they're growing in the soil naturally. Or go to a smaller raised bed situation, something along those lines, but you don't want to make a huge raised bed because that'll negatively impact the trees too. So those might be the best ways to go in a situation like that, particularly when you've got other constrictions, the way it may sound, as far as whether it be light or whether it be soil and nutrient status.
Right, because the light, there's so many trees that there's not a whole lot of light coming through,
yep.
But yet she wants to plant something, and whatever she's tried, I don't remember what it is, that just wasn't working, so.
Yeah, like I say, I especially if she's had some negative experiences with the soil that's under there, I would strongly consider just doing some buried containers or some smaller, not necessarily small, but shorter and broader containers so that she has a better soil quality there for types of plants, because a lot of our flowering plants will not do very well unless they have good sunlight and better moisture and nutrient status available to them. And underneath most of our native pine stands, it's not going to be the case. So we might need to just do some extra work there to get them to look the way we want.
Okay, thank you. God bless you, and thank you for the show. I really enjoy it, and I'll tell that to my mom then. Thank you.
Thank you, Samantha, very much. Appreciate your call. Wayne in Eau Claire has a question for you, Scott. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Larry. Hey, love the show. Listen to you every chance I got. I have read on some web blogs and some organic magazines, publications, that marigolds and maybe petunias or chrysanthemums, if you put them in your vegetable garden, they help prevent certain insects. But then I've read in some like more scholarly articles and magazines that's not the case. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
There's truth both ways. This is one of the concepts called within the overall topic of companion planting. And companion planting is certainly a beneficial management technique in a lot of situations. Now, my research into companion planting indicates that the insect management side of it is probably the least predictable ones of companion planting, unfortunately. The marigold issues that you talked about, marigolds do have repellent effects, but there's a trick. They have very good repellency effects against nematodes the year after, not the year during. And the same applies to a number of different things. Now, some of the ones that actually can come into play in Wisconsin vegetable gardens that are worth trying, especially if you have smaller garden areas, is that a number of the alliums, the onion, garlic family, they will repel things a little bit within the lepidopteran pests that affect the cabbage family. So interspersing alliums in your cabbage family plantings can sometimes help minimize the number of insects that are going to affect your cabbage plants. So it's one way to do it, but companion planting is a very broad topic. There are a number of plants that really are very good for each other. You know, one area within insects are some of the perennial herbs underneath fruit trees can actually help minimize, not again completely eliminate, but help minimize some of those types of issues that we have to face with our fruit trees. And many other situations, you know, and all kinds of different stuff out there. And companion planting is kind of something that's near to my heart, because doing a combination or a joint presentation with her is how I actually proposed to my wife. So,
So there is some companion planting going on.
That was how I worked it in, yes.
Well, I never proposed to anybody in the garden, but I just like the way that it looks with the flowers scattered through the garden. And I guess I don't plant things in rows or anything like that. I just put stuff out there, and then it's always a surprise when I find it, when it's, you know, ripe, when I'm wandering through the garden. That's the reason I did it. But I had read that several places, and I just didn't know, you know, how effective it was or if it was. But, that's a great answer. Thank you.
There are definite benefits. And one of the most positive things we actually get from companion planting, whether we're doing it by row, by group, or by plant, like it sounds like you do, is that we create a more diverse environment. And by doing so, we create a better environment for our beneficial insects, both pollinators and predators and parasites. So we actually get some significant benefits. They're just hard to measure.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Someone wondered if they could leave their orchids for a couple of months at 60 degree temperatures in the house while they're in Florida or someplace warm. Yeah, yes or no on that?
I think so. It may be dictated by which particular orchids they're talking about, because there are some differences from species to species of those. But most of them, I think, can handle 60 degrees. You just have to double check for sure, because most of them are high-value plants, and I'd hate to be wrong.
Yeah, Phalaenopsis, I think, are pretty hardy that way. Scott, it's always a pleasure. I hope you'll be with us again.
Yeah, if you have me back, I'll be here.
All right. Scott Royce, our guest today. Scott is the UW Extension Crop Soils Horticulture Agent for Marinette, Oconto, and Florence Counties. Doesn't he do a great job? I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, Gordon and Portage and others. I'm sorry. Tell you what, Monday we'll talk about the bad food Bible, how and why to eat sinfully. Oh, my goodness me. That should be a lot of fun. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.